It's Monday, September 14, 2020, just after market close in New York. This is the Real Vision Daily Briefing. I'm Ash Bennington, joined shortly by our managing editor, Ed Harrison. But first, in the next segment, a live update with Jack Farley. Jack, welcome back.
Great to be here, Ash.
So, Jack, I'm curious about what you're looking at this morning. I see that OPEC has released their monthly report, the MOMR, the monthly oil market report. What are your thoughts there?
Yes, well, Ash, the biggest news in that report is that OPEC lowered their forecast for global demand. For 2020, it was set at 90.6 million last month in July. They set it now to 90.2 million barrels per day. So this is a 9.5% decline from 2019. It's a second month in a row that OPEC has lowered their estimate. And they didn't just lower it for 2020. They lowered it for 2021 as well. So definitely a very gloomy outlook for oil.
Yeah, oil trading below 40 bucks a barrel right now. Brent at 39, spot 77 as we roll into the close in the afternoon. And WTI at 37, spot 35. Jack, I'm also curious, what were your takeaways on the supply side from the report?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, Ash, I know you follow the news flow like a hawk. I'm sure you've seen a lot of stories of Halliburton cutting their workforce in half. Oil and gas explorers drastically reducing CapEx. You can see that if you look at the Baker Hughes rig count. What's funny is that the supply of oil has not declined as rapidly as the demand. So I think the story is that demand is far more elastic than supply. If you look at a variety of producers across OPEC as well as non-OPEC regions, you'll see that production declined only between 3% and 10%, whereas the demand for countries was about 5% to 10%. So yes, definitely very bearish for oil. Yeah. And OPEC, by the way, on Thursday, the cartel will have a meeting. It's online, of course. We'll see if it's over Zoom to discuss their plans in general in greater detail.
Well, you know, that makes sense, Jack. I'm not an oil maven by any means, but, you know, this isn't just a widget factory where you're stamping out widgets and you can, you know, basically tell the workers on the line to go home. You have a physically pressurized commodity underground. You have an elaborate infrastructure for extracting it. It probably makes sense that the supply is more inelastic than demand. Jack, anything else you're looking at in the oil markets?
Yeah, Ash, it's interesting. The report from OPEC wasn't the only report that came out today that was bearish on oil. BP released a report that also painted a grim picture for oil. They had four scenarios ranging from business as usual to rapid decarbonization. And across them, they had projections that indicate a 2.5 to 3.5 drop in GDP all the way through 2050. So I've seen projections like this before, but they usually come from, you know, a green energy think tank or something like Bloomberg New Energy Finance. It's quite interesting to see this come from an oil company itself.
Yeah, interesting for a couple of reasons. First, as a proxy for aggregate demand, and second, as an index of what may be happening on the decarbonization front.
Definitely.
Jack, as always, great stuff. Thanks for joining us.
So great to be here, Ash. Enjoy your talk with Ed.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Thanks, Jack. Welcome back, Ed.
Yes, good to talk to you, Ash. And you know what's on my mind, actually, just before this, I was looking at Chelsea 1-0 at halftime against Brighton. Brighton at home, Chelsea away. The Premier League has begun.
So this is a new season? This is like the 2021 season?
That's right. 2021 season of the Premier League has begun just after, you know, the Champions League was over. So it's like nonstop soccer now, nonstop football.
No rest for the wicked.
No. And also, when I say nonstop football, American football as well, of course, just kicked off.
Indeed.
So I know that people came here to hear Market, so I'm going to stop with the banter about sports. But, you know, we do have other lives.
I was going to say, we've got plenty of wonkiness to delve into today.
Oh, yeah, definitely, without a doubt.
So start us off. What are you thinking about?
Yeah, so I was telling you before we got on, I was talking about, I wrote a post on Credit Write-Downs about this so-called retail investor-led speculative mania and worries about that. And it was generated by, I thought, a really good Odd Lots podcast from Bloomberg. This is a podcast that they do, I think, twice a week with Joe Weisenthal and Tracy Alloway. They had a guy on who was talking about options, Ben Eifert. And he really broke it down really well in terms of thinking about this whole short gamma thing that we were talking about 2 weeks ago, and also where retail investors fit into that.
Yeah, it really is an interesting podcast. I had a chance to listen to it, and I actually read the Credit Write-Downs. Lots of questions, maybe more questions than answers.
Yeah, I think that the way I'd frame it when we have the conversation today is we can talk about it within the context of historical precedent, thinking about that, not just drilling down into the weeds of options pricing and delta hedging and gamma, but you know what this all means in terms of where we are in the cycle.
Right, and that's exactly how you start out the Credit Write-Downs note. So give us a little bit of the historical context that led to your thinking right now.
Yeah, so the historical context is, I get the sense, let me just back up and say that some of the stuff that Ben Eifert was talking about made me think about me 20 years ago, 25 years ago during the internet bubble and the kinds of things that I was doing as a relatively novice investor. And the things that he was talking about people doing now, the equivalent things that I would have been doing and people who I know would have been doing back then. Now we have different instruments, but it was relatively speaking the same kind of, wrong position sizing, massive speculative activity that we see today. And the light bulb went off for me. I was like, ding, ding, the people who are doing it today are not the same people who were doing it 20, 25 years ago. They're different people. They're new people. And it seems like every generation, there's a bubble of sorts. And I go through, in the United States history in terms of the panics, the bubbles that ended in panics in the 19th century and the early 20th century, the 1819, 1837, 1857, 1873, 1893, 1907. Then 1907 was so bad when J.P. Morgan had to intervene, we got the Federal Reserve. People thought central bank, hey, that will do the trick. The first, the Roaring Twenties, the first big bull market ended in the Great Depression. And interestingly, because the Great Depression was so great, it seems like we had a blip and we had tight regulation that stopped the next speculative mania for two generations instead of one generation. Maybe World War II had something to do with it. And then we had the Nifty 50, followed by the internet bubble. And now we have this pandemic bubble, let's call it.
Yeah, it's so interesting. 1907, the bankers panic or the Knickerbocker panic leading to the creation of the Federal Reserve, suppressing volatility. And some would say the Austrians especially didn't prevent it, but perhaps accelerated it and allowed those imbalances to build for longer. That's not necessarily my position, but that is at times the thinking. But here we are again. A quick recap, if you haven't heard the podcast yet, about what Ben Eifert had to say to Joe Weisenthal and Tracy Alloway. Effectively, this time, it's about options. And Eifert points out that S&P options volumes are clustering around expiry. That's something on the order of 30 to 40% of the options buying is taking place within about 24 hours of expiry. There's similar action in tech companies. This is all from the publicly available OCC data. The key point here that Eifert makes is small traders are buying bullish call options, and they're being done in odd lots. You can see this because they're about 50 or less per trade. And on a trailing 1 month basis, they would have been on the order of about $100 billion in notional trading several years ago. Today, now, at 500 billion.
Yeah, so a parabolic rise in 2020, including actually pre-pandemic. So this is actually not just about people being at home and saying, okay, I have nothing better to do. That certainly exacerbated it. But we saw the uptick already in 2018, and then it moved to new heights by the time that we got to 2020.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's interesting. One of the sort of dichotomies that Eifert sets up is this notion of the SoftBank trade on one hand versus the Robinhood trade on the other. In other words, one institutional whale versus the idea that there are many retail traders who are crowding into a market. And that is really the central question of the thesis. And I believe it's Eifert's contention that it looks much more like a retail-driven mania.
Yeah, I think there are two parts to that. One is that, you know, when I think back to the late 90s in terms of the option buying that I would have done, or early 2000s, or that people I know would have done, we were talking about month expiries, you know, 1 month out, 3 months out, 6 months out, things of that nature. But now we have a much more proliferated market in terms of options. You can take overnight positions, you can take two-day positions, the gamut, you can run the gamut in terms of how short week positions, et cetera. And so the most important thing to understand is that, you know, whoever's on the other side of these positions that are being taken they're usually having to hedge out the delta, the change that is associated with when the price of the underlying stock moves. So you're buying this option, and it's not necessarily another retail investor on the other side. It's usually a market maker who doesn't want to take a position. They're just giving you flow. And so when they give the flow and the price moves, because these are very short-dated options, it means that the convexity, that is the curvilinear relationship, is so far from linear that it's a big move in terms of the delta hedging that they have to undertake. And the delta hedging that they undertake is really effectively because they're effectively short the stock. They have to go and buy. So a large move in the underlying price means you get a large delta hedging effect and that amplifies the move tremendously. A perfect example, Salesforce.com. When they released their earnings, the stock popped. But because you had all these short-dated single-name stock call options on Salesforce.com, everyone had to, in the dealer community, had to buy, and that amplified the move. And so you went up. It was like a third or fourth, fifth standard deviation move that one day.
Yeah, two critical points there. That curvilinear relationship is the rate of change of delta, and that's the gamma, and that's the rate at which the price of the option changes relative to the price of the underlying security. And the second point, and Eifert does a great job of explaining this, is people are not taking offsetting positions. So in other words, there's not another retail trader on the opposite side of your trade. When you buy a call, there's not someone buying a put. There's a broker dealer in the middle, and they have to hedge that position. And the rate at which they need to hedge that is related to the delta. So in other words, the degree to which the price will change in the option is the degree to which that they need to be hedged. So they don't have to fully hedge that position. If you buy 100 calls, they don't have to buy 100 shares of the underlying. And this is really what makes this such a challenging situation to understand, because there really are kind of multiple levels of variables here, and frankly, derivatives of derivatives, which gets a little bit complicated if you're not used to thinking about it.
Yeah, and so obviously, if you're a retail investor, then that complication, you miss that completely.
Right.
So in a different market environment, you could be caught blindsided, you know, because obviously, you know, this curvilinear relationship is there for the downside as well as the upside. So that's what we saw. We saw a massive retrenchment in terms of all this call buying in the last week. It was a great chart that Eifert put up showing what the numbers look like. It was a parabolic rise, and then, you know, about halfway down, you came in terms of the retail investment call buying for the last week when everything was going pear-shaped. The interesting bit for me there was in terms of talking about the options whale, SoftBank not being in the options whale, is that SoftBank They were doing a strategy that was more traditional in terms of the length of the option that they were buying. They were buying these call spreads, you know, 3 months out, as an example, you would say August to November.
Right.
And
that's lower convexity.
Exactly. The convexity is less. And so therefore, you're not going to get this massive buying, this massive reaction from the dealer community. So Eifert believes that it's less what was going on as a result of SoftBank, but more what was going on in a concerted, potentially collusive effort by people to pump up these shares in the most obvious places, the likes of Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, Google, Microsoft, and Tesla. These are the names that people know in the retail community, and those are the names that they were buying.
Yeah, exactly. Let me just make two points, Ed, that may seem too obvious to mention, but I think are important to set the stage for what we're talking about. The first is, why options in the first place? Why are retail investors moving to it? And I think there are two answers. The first is the general one, which is, as Mike Green says, it's a non-recourse leverage. You can get leverage without recourse, meaning you're not going to be able to, if you're buying the options rather than writing the options, you're able to effectively control a larger notional position with a smaller premium. So you have leverage without recourse. And the second point that I think is sometimes gets lost in the shuffle is one of the key variables, one of the key inputs to the Black-Scholes model is the risk-free rate. So when interest rates are incredibly low, the cost of carry on these options is much, much lower. So it makes perfect sense that we would see this this kind of enthusiasm among retail investors for those products now.
Yeah, interesting how the Fed is driving unforeseen consequences in that way. You know, one thing that I would say is if you ever see a chart of how options are charted, you know, the chart, it looks like a straight line at every point below where the strike price is, if the option ends there, and then it's a one-to-one relationship beyond that. And the interesting bit for me in terms of that that hockey stick look is that it's much better than the underlying, plus you get leverage for anyone who wants to make a speculative bet, a one-way call, because what they're trying to say is look, you know, I'm not going to lose my shirt because of this leverage. All I'll lose is my full amount that I invested in this particular bet. No more. It's not, you know, like with the underlying security, it's a straight line. That means that as the stock goes down and you have leverage on that, you lose the amount of leverage that you have. But with this particular bet, all you can lose is the principal that you invested in the call.
Yeah, assuming that you're the taker, right? Assuming that you're buying the option, if you're writing calls, in theory you have unlimited upside risk. You can, because the price of the stock can go up to infinity and you're stuck with having to make good on the opposite position.
Right. Which is why you want to hedge that out if you're a money maker, a market maker.
Yeah, and now increasingly even retail are getting into writing calls, and obviously there's some risk there. In fact, quite a lot of risk there. That's not
indeed. Yeah. So you know, I went over this. I was thinking about this, and I was talking to a friend of mine, and I was saying to him before, I was like, you know, how do you know a mania is happening when it's happening? And I said, for me, it's reached now a point when I think about these dynamics in the same way that it reached when we had the housing bubble in the United States. I remember here in the DC area where I am, I would look at house prices and I would see a house that was for sale. And, you know, I could work out the math for a 10% down mortgage payment for that house, and let's say it was $3,800. The equivalent house on, you know, in the same area was renting for $1,700. So how is it possible that I could rent this place for $1,700 and a mortgage 10% down is $3,800? The two just are so diametrically apart, right, that there's no way that you can close that gap. I kept on coming back to that over and over again during the housing bubble when I took positions, you know, to short the likes of, actually I took some option positions as well, you know, for Washington Mutual, things like that. And that was why, because there's no way that that's sustainable.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Turned out to be a good bet since WAMU no longer exists. And I thought that was so well said. It really is the perfect metaphor for this. It isn't quite a one-to-one correspondence in that, you know, it's not a derivative, but it gives you a sense mentally, if you're not like deep into the options math, of understanding how you can look at numbers and see an imbalance between, the, for example, the rental price and the purchase price of a home. And you said earlier, look, you know, there are things you can do with a home. You can knock it down. You can expand on it. You mentioned a whole list of other things that you can do to it. But when the premium is that significant over the rental price, that's not what we're talking about, right? That's something completely different. That is a dynamic of a market that looks to be lopsided.
Yeah, and so then the question is you know, what happens? When does that market go down? And I think this is the interesting bit for me, because we're in an unprecedented period in many ways. I look back at the data that I had that was available to see, you know, around recessions, what happened. So we're in the worst post-World War II economic downturn that we've ever seen. We're out of that now. We're in sort of a rally period. But, you know, the global recession was the worst that we've ever seen. And when you looked at U.S. recessions in the past, what you see is that the market goes down even before the recession begins. And it continues to go down through the recession. It's when the recession is over or right about around that time that it bounces back. The concept that we've had the worst recession and March the 23rd was the low, and then we're off to the races and we're even higher than we were before at this particular juncture, says either A, we're in a sustained and sustainable recovery that will continue, or you're going to have to close that gap between the real economy and the financial economy, and it's going to be closed with share prices going down.
Yeah, talking of which, off to the races, NASDAQ up today, 1.87%, 200 points, closing at over 11,000 at 11,056. Russell 2000 up 2.65%, closing over 1,500 at 1,536. S&P up 1.25% approximately, closing at 3,383.
Yeah, so definitely off to the races. It looks like the correction's over for the NASDAQ at this point. And so the unprecedented part is the fact that we had this monster downtick in the economy, and yet, you know, in the middle of all of the problems, I mean, in the middle of it, during the recession, we had this parabolic rise, both in terms of the volume of option buying and also in terms of the underlying share prices.
Yeah, exactly. You know, this has got me thinking about something, Ed, and that is who's benefiting from this? Quo bene, who's really benefiting from this? And I think the reality is that sophisticated investors, especially hedge funds, CTAs, people who have the ability to hire folks with PhDs in applied mathematics and physics and nonlinear dynamic systems, people who have the money to invest in technology like AI to sort out these correlations, are probably doing gangbuster business right now. And they're probably not talking about it very loudly, would be my guess. You know, it's really interesting. If you think about the series of scandals we had a few years back with the specialist networks, we know that the trajectory of future earnings are very difficult to predict. In fact, we saw some of the top hedge funds on Wall Street getting embroiled in scandals around buying potentially, allegedly material non-public information. We had people indicted. We had people convicted. Some folks went to jail for it. This is something different, Ed. This is about mathematical relationships that have a predictable trajectory, at least in the aggregate. You know, I'm definitely getting out way over my skis even talking about this here, but the math for this stuff is really gnarly, right? Stochastic differential equations solved in continuous time. These are really like brain bulging type of mathematics that we have to go through to get it. But I would be willing to bet that there are people out there who are looking at this, seeing a tremendous opportunity.
Yeah, they are. The question though, of course, is when does that opportunity crystallize in terms of profits for them? Because right now, if you are one of these retail investors, many of the times you're doing well. It'll continue until it doesn't continue. And I think the question for people like yourself and for me is what makes us think that we know more? Maybe this time is different. Maybe it won't end in tears this time. Maybe you should suspend disbelief and you should say to yourself that actually you can close that gap, just like the proverbial 3,800 to 1,700 gap gets closed by the market trading sideways for a period of 10 years while things catch up. That's the kind of thinking that you have to go through in order to come out with a situation in which this doesn't end, with a very sharp correction, sharp bear market.
I had the feeling you had something else to add beyond that, because I know maybe this time is different, Ed. I have a feeling there's another shoe to drop.
Yeah, I think that there is another shoe to drop. I think that we're in unprecedented times, but you do have to leave the possibility open.
Yeah.
That because this is unprecedented in terms of the kind of activity that we're seeing in the middle of a recession, a pandemic, that perhaps the outcome will be different as well.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts, Ed? How does this shake out? What are you going to be looking for to understand the trajectory? And what do you think the scenarios are on the back end here?
You know, I always go to the real economy. That is, I think that real economy weakness will induce a weakness in terms of share prices. And so I'm looking for that. I think that when we got the rally again, we had it was a liquidity event in March, and so then we got a rally. There was a basing, and it wasn't until the reopening really affirmed that, okay, we can get back in gear and that we're going to get this V-shaped bounce off of the bottom, that we really saw shares start to take off. So I think that there is a overlay that you have some sort of real economy effect, and it may be amplified in a parabolic way, in a very artificial way, but it's there. So on the downside, we could see the same thing. So that's what I'm looking for, is to see what, if any, kind of economic weakness, any kind of earnings weakness that we would have, and to see that play through in terms of, we can't just have multiple expansion even when earnings and the economy are down. I think that's what the catalyst will be.
Ed, as always, well said.
Thanks, Ash. And just to reiterate, we're not oracles. We don't know any more than anyone else does, but historical precedent says that manias don't end well.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I suspect that will remain true for the time being and probably into the future.